This is actually the first of two presentations that should have been back-to-back, but it didn't kind of work out that way. So I'm going to give the sort of the development, how we put these thresholds together, and then in about an hour, Peter in Salon 6 is going to tell you how we implemented it in our system in Arizona. I'd also like to acknowledge Tim Vandervoit, who was our PhD student, who was actually, this was actually his PhD project. Tim is with the equivalent of USDA in New Zealand now, working on fruit tree IPM. So, as we all know, IPM is made up of many facets, many tactics that we put together into an overall IPM program. We like to think of it as a pyramid. On the base of that pyramid are a number of tactics and strategies that help you reduce the insect pressure to begin with. If that's working well enough, you don't really need to bother with the upper two layers of the pyramid. But if that's not sufficient, then you'll need to have a good sampling plan, understand when you need to make treatment decisions, and keep in mind how we manage those insecticides through resistance programs and things of that nature. So this is where we were in the 1990s. Maybe this is what Georgia looks like right now. I'm not really sure. But this is a famous picture from the Imperial Valley of California. Those are little seedlings of something coming up, and this cloud of whiteflies is descending upon them, so these things don't have a chance. And this is what a windshield might look like if you drove through that area, and here's what a cotton leaf might look like if you turned it over. So we were at a point where we were experiencing extreme losses from this insect in all kinds of crops, including cotton. If you get high enough population levels, you'll get defoliation and huge impacts on yield. But we're really typically focused on the quality issues. So the whitefly, as a phloem-feeding insect, exudes honeydew. The honeydew gets on the lint. It makes the lint sticky. It provides a medium for sooty molds to grow. And so the real issue with whiteflies is not yield, it's quality. And that's what our programs are focused on in Arizona, is to preserve that quality. So here's where we are currently. So in the early 90s, as you might expect, we were spraying a lot. We had whiteflies, we had pink bollworms, we had Liguus bugs, other insects. We were spraying an average of 9 to 10 times per year in the early 90s. Then a couple of big things happened in 96. We got BT cotton, which took care of our pink bollworm problem increasingly. We developed an IPM program based on selective insecticides for whitefly and then eventually for Liguus. And it basically, we saw a huge reduction, historically low insecticide use in the state of Arizona, down to less than two applications for all insects in the last decade. And about half of those, we spray about a half a time per season for whiteflies averaged overall. And what's not reflected here is that when we do apply insecticides, we're using mainly selective materials. So about 85% of the materials we use are actually highly selective and kill only the pests and not the beneficials. So, as you might expect, because of this low insecticide use environment, we are really trying to capitalize on the biological control capacity in the system. And that's really one of the major foundations of our IPM program, in addition to a lot of other things that we look at in the base of this pyramid. But we're really focused primarily on conserving the natural enemies and how we can utilize them most effectively in our management programs. And so you might think, well, a half a spray a year, I mean, what's the point of trying to improve on that? Well, what if we got rid of sprays altogether? What the heck, you know? Might as well go for it. So there's the concept that we should be making decisions not only based on the pest, but based on what biological control capacity in the system. That idea has been around for a while. It's been variably called inaction levels or beneficial thresholds. We're calling them biological control informed thresholds, and maybe that'll become clear as I work through why we're calling it that. But the idea is that we should be basing our decisions on more information, which is going to reduce risk and give us the best outcomes. So in Arizona, as in probably much of the cotton belt, we have a wide variety of beneficial insects that inhabit cotton. In Arizona, we work with about 20 commonly abundant predator species, a few parasitoids that attack whiteflies. So there's a lot of capacity in the system for biological control, and the point of trying to what we're trying to do with these thresholds is to capitalize on this community and use them to help us manage even better, do even better management of our insect problems. These predators and parasitoids exist in a complex food web, and this is just kind of a confusing picture of a lot of spaghetti. A lot of the generalist predators feed not only on herbivores in the system, but they feed on each other, they feed on the parasitoids, they feed on the plants. It's quite a dynamic and ever-changing complex, but there's a lot of resiliency and a lot of redundancy built into this community because of their general feeding habits. So what I'm going to do is explain how we went through developing these biocontrol-informed thresholds. These are the various steps that we used in order to do that. So we first started by manipulating predator and prey populations so we could get a variety of dynamics to look at the interaction between the pests and the predators. We then used that to select specific natural enemies that we saw associated with biological control of whiteflies, and then we took those six natural enemies and we optimized the ratios associated with using predator to prey ratios, optimized those to come to a number of decision tools that we can use. And then Peter, as I mentioned, is gonna primarily talk about the demonstration and outreach component of this in an hour down the hall. So to start with the basic experimental design, we used a variety of selective and non-selective insecticides to manipulate both the populations of the whitefly and the natural enemies. So, you know, those 20 or so major predators that I was talking about, we looked at which ones were connected to whiteflies and which ones were not. And this is just showing you that, in fact, our manipulations were successful in getting a range of different densities of pests and predators. This is the pest data. This is large nymphs per leaf disc, which is our common metric for measuring whiteflies in cotton. And you can see on the left-hand side there that some of those treatments had major impacts on predators. Some of them had few or no impacts on predators, and vice versa on the pests. So what we were after was a range of different densities of both the predators and the prey. And this is an example of what happened to the predators. So these are some multivariate analysis that we typically use to look at non-target effects. So think of that y-axis, that canonical coefficient, think of that as just a measure of density relative to the untreated check, which is that gray line at zero across the top. And you can see that some of our treatments were very similar to the untreated check, and some of them were a lot worse than the untreated check, and the point of that was to reduce predator populations or leave them unaffected. So based on all of that manipulation, we were able to identify six predator species that were associated with whitefly biological control: Colops beetles, Chrysoperla, green lacewings, crab spiders, big-eyed bugs, minute pirate bugs, and a little impidid fly, which is quite common in our system, Drapetus, which is pretty much a whitefly adult specialist, a very interesting insect. So what we did was we tried to refine what these thresholds should look like for these six predators. And this is an example of how we looked at that. So each one of those dots on that graphic is actually one condition of a predator-prey connection. Those are predator-prey ratios on the y-axis as a function of whitefly nymph density on the x-axis. And you can see that this kind of delineates some different zones of what's going on. So when you have either low whitefly populations or very high predator-to-prey ratios, life is easy. You don't really need to be doing anything. Biological control is functioning at a very high level, and you don't need to make any decisions there. On the flip side, if those whitefly populations are high and those predator-to-prey ratios are very low, that means you need to be doing something. or you should have done something before you got to this point. So what we're really focusing on is this sort of this middle zone here. So that line going down the center of the yellow box is actually our current pest-centric threshold. That's one large nymph per leaf disc on a cotton leaf. But we know that that there's a range of outcomes that could happen depending on that density. And so we're trying to refine this, what we call this zone of uncertainty. So here's where we're really trying to hone and understand what those predator-prey ratios should be. So we're really functioning, we're trying to find out what's functioning within this peri-threshold level. And another way to look at that is here's our typical decision matrix where we either spray or don't spray depending on the density here. I'm using a log scale so I can get a linear line. So that zero is actually our one whitefly nymph per disc. You either spray or you don't spray if it's above or below that threshold. But really with the additional information provided by the natural enemies, we actually have four zones of decision. So we still have our spray and don't spray. Those were the green and the red areas in the previous graph. But we also have a couple of other areas where we might be able to defer a spray if those densities, those predator-prey ratios are high enough. Or we might need to advance a spray if those predator-prey ratios are not high enough. So it works both ways. We might actually be able to defer a spray, but we might need to be spraying earlier if for some reason the dynamics that year are such that our predators are not as abundant as they typically are. So this is what we're really trying to do to reduce risk in the decision process. So we took those ratios that we got for those six predators, and then we optimized them based on looking at the possible outcomes of decisions. Looks something like this. So these are relative to a pest-centric situation. We have either early sprays or late sprays. And what we tried to do was to optimize the decision error so that we're getting the lowest error for both of those situations. And that, in this example, is for our drapetus flies, our impidid flies. It takes 8 flies per 100 sweeps to 5 whitefly adults per leaf, or 1 whitefly adult per leaf. That would be our ratio. And that would be something that would minimize the error of our decisions. So this is what our this is our cast of characters. As I mentioned earlier, crab spiders, green lacewings, minute pirate bugs, Geocorus, Colops beetles, and our drapetus fly. And these are the ratios that represent the action threshold, as it were, that we're trying to deploy. And you can see there's a variety of different levels. Sometimes it takes quite a few predators before you reach that threshold, 44-1 for drapetus flies if you're looking at nymphal whitefly populations. But the way we're looking at this is that any one of these thresholds, if they're exceeded, would be a reason to defer a spray. So we're really using these as a proxy for the activity of the entire predator community. So just in a nutshell, this is kind of back to the idea of just a pest-centric, so we have a single decision point that we're either spraying or not spraying. We're not using any additional information, but if we are able to use that additional information, we get a diagram that looks something like this. So we have now a broader range of decision area that we can hone. Sometimes we can defer a spray. Sometimes we need to spray a little bit earlier, but the idea is that this is based on a lot more information than we were using before. And that removes the uncertainty and helps the grower make even better decisions about pest control. And if you want to read more about this, we published a paper in 2018 based on this, and we're still working on getting Tim to write up the remaining two papers, or one or two papers, that are going to talk about the validation and the implementation. But once again, if you want to hear about the implementation, visit Peter's talk at 9 o'clock down the hall. Thanks a lot, and we just want to thank our sponsors and the many, many people that were involved in this work.